were in a stationary or retrograde state. With such a disposition, the Latins should have derived the most early and essential benefits from a series of events which opened to their eyes the prospect of the world, and introduced them to a long and frequent intercourse with the more cultivated regions of the East. The first and most obvious progress was in trade and manufactures, in the arts which are strongly prompted by the thirst of wealth, the calls of necessity, and the gratification of the sense or vanity. Among the crowd of unthinking fanatics, a captive or a pilgrim might sometimes observe the superior refinements of Cairo and Constantinople. The first importer of windmills was the benefactor of nations, and if such blessings are enjoyed without any grateful remembrance, history has condescended to notice the more apparent luxuries of silk and sugar, which were transported into Italy from Greece and Egypt. But the intellectual wants of the Latins were more slowly felt and supplied. The ardor of studious curiosity was awakened in Europe by different causes and more recent events, and in the age of the Crusades, they viewed with careless indifference the literature of the Greeks and Arabians. Some rudiments of mathematical and medicinal knowledge might be imparted in practice and in figures. Necessity might produce some interpreters for the grosser business of merchants and soldiers. But the commerce of the Orientals had not diffused the study and knowledge of their languages in the schools of Europe. If a similar principle of religion repulsed the idiom of the Koran, it should have excited their patience and curiosity to understand the original text of the gospel. And the same grammar would have unfolded the sense of Plato and the beauties of Homer. Yet in a reign of 60 years, the Latins of Constantinople disdained the speech and learning of their subjects, and the manuscripts were the only treasures which the natives might enjoy without rapine or envy. Aristotle was indeed the oracle of the Western universities, but it was a barbarous Aristotle, and instead of ascending to the fountainhead, his Latin votaries humbly accepted a corrupt and remote version from the Jews and Moors of Andalusia. The principle of the Crusades was a savage fanaticism, and the most important effects were analogous to the cause. Each pilgrim was ambitious to return with his sacred spoils, the relics of Greece and Palestine, and each relic was preceded and followed by a train of miracles and visions. The belief of the Catholics was corrupted by new legends, their practice by new superstitions, and the establishment of the Inquisition, the mendicant orders of monks and friars, the last abuse of indulgences, and the final progress of idolatry flowed from the baleful fountain of the Holy War. The active spirit of the Latins preyed on the vitals of their reason and religion, and if the 9th and 10th centuries were the times of darkness, the 13th and 14th were the age of absurdity and fable. In the profession of Christianity, in the cultivation of a fertile land, the northern conquerors of the Roman Empire insensibly mingled with the provincials and rekindled the embers of the arts of antiquity. Their settlements about the age of Charlemagne had acquired some degree of order and stability when they were overwhelmed by new swarms of invaders, the Normans, Saracens, and Hungarians, who replunged the western countries of Europe into their former state of anarchy and barbarism. About the 11th century, the second tempest had subsided by the expulsion or conversion of the enemies of Christendom. The tide of civilization, which had so long ebbed, began to flow with a steady and accelerated course, and a fairer prospect was opened to the hopes and efforts of the rising generations. Great was the increase and rapid the progress during the 200 years of the Crusades, and some philosophers have applauded the propitious influence of these holy wars, which appear to me to have checked rather than forwarded the maturity of Europe. The lives and labors of millions which were buried in the East would have been more profitably employed in the improvement of their native country. The accumulated stock of industry and wealth would have overflowed in navigation and trade, and the Latins would have been enriched and enlightened by pure and friendly correspondence with the climates of the East. In one respect I can indeed perceive the accidental operation of the Crusades, not so much in producing a benefit as in removing an evil. The larger portion of the inhabitants of Europe was chained to the soil, without freedom, or property, or knowledge. And the two orders of ecclesiastics and nobles, whose numbers were comparatively small, alone deserved the name of citizens and men. This oppressive system was supported by the arts of the clergy and the swords of the barons. The authority of the priests operated in the darker ages as a salutary antidote. They prevented the total extinction of letters, mitigated the fierceness of the times, sheltered the poor and defenseless, and preserved, or revived, the peace and order of civil society. But the independence, rapine, and discord of the feudal lords were unmixed with any semblance of good, and every hope of industry and improvement was crushed by the iron weight of the martial aristocracy. Among the causes that undermined that Gothic edifice, a conspicuous place must be allowed to the Crusades. The estates of the barons were dissipated, and their race was often extinguished in these costly and perilous expeditions. Their poverty extorted from their pride those charters of freedom, which unlocked the fetters of the slave, secured the farm of the peasant, and the shop of the artificer, and gradually restored a substance and a soul to the most numerous and useful part of the community. The conflagration which destroyed the tall and barren trees of the forest gave air and scope to the vegetation of the smaller and nutritive plants of the soil. While Joscelin reigned beyond the Euphrates, his elder brother Milo, the son of Joscelin, the son of Aether, continued, near the Seine, to possess the castle of their fathers, which was at length inherited by Reinaud, or Reginald, the youngest of his three sons. Examples of genius or virtue must be rare in the annals of the oldest families, and in a remote age their pride will embrace a deed of rapine and violence. Such, however, as could not be perpetrated without some superiority of courage, or at least of power. A descendant of Reginald of Courtenay may blush for the public robber who stripped and imprisoned several merchants after they had satisfied the king's duties at Sand and Orléans. He will glory in the offence, since the bold offender could not be compelled to obedience and restitution till the regent and the count of Champagne prepared to march against him at the head of an army. Reginald bestowed his estates on his eldest daughter and his daughter on the seventh son of King Louis the Fat, and their marriage was crowned with a numerous offspring. We might expect that a private should have merged in a royal name, and that the descendants of Peter of France and Elizabeth of Courtenay would have enjoyed the titles and honours of princes of the blood. But this legitimate claim was long neglected and finally denied, and the causes of their disgrace will represent the story of this second branch. Of all the families now extant, the most ancient, doubtless, and the most illustrious is the House of France, which has occupied the same throne above 800 years, and descends in a clear and lineal series of males from the middle of the 9th century. In the age of the Crusades, it was already revered, both in the East and West. But from Hugh Capet to the marriage of Peter, no more than 5 reigns or generations had elapsed, and so precarious was their title that the eldest sons, as a necessary precaution, were previously crowned during the lifetime of their fathers. The peers of France have long maintained their precedency before the younger branches of the royal line, nor had the princes of the blood in the 12th century acquired that hereditary lustre which is now diffused over the most remote candidates for the succession. The barons of Courtenay must have stood high in their own estimation, and in that of the world, since they could impose on the son of a king the obligation of adopting for himself and all his descendants the name and arms of their daughter and his wife. In the marriage of an heiress with her inferior or her equal, such exchange often required and allowed. But as they continued to diverge from the regal stem, the sons of Louis the Fat were insensibly confounded with their maternal ancestors, and the new Courtenays might deserve to forfeit the honours of their birth, which a motive of interest had tempted them to renounce. The shame was far more permanent than the reward, and a momentary blaze was followed by long darkness. The eldest son of these nuptials, Peter of Courtenay, had married, as I have already mentioned, the sister of the Counts of Flanders, the two first emperors of Constantinople. He rashly accepted the invitation of the barons of Romania. His two sons, Robert and Baldwin, successively held and lost the remains of the Latin Empire in the East, and the granddaughter of Baldwin II again mingled her blood with the blood of France and of Valois. To support the expenses of a troubled and transitory reign, their patrimonial estates were mortgaged or sold, and the last emperors of Constantinople depended on the annual charity of Rome and Naples. While the elder brothers dissipated their wealth in romantic adventures, and the castle of Courtenay was profaned by a plebeian owner, the younger branches of that adopted name were propagated and multiplied. But their splendor was clouded by poverty and time. After the decease of Robert, great butler of France, they descended from princes to barons. The next generations were confounded with the simple gentry. The descendants of Hugh Capet could no longer be visible in the rural lords of Tanlai and of Champignel. The more adventurous embraced without dishonor the profession of a soldier. The least active and opulent might sink, like their cousins of the branch of Drieu, into the condition of peasants. Their royal descent, in a dark period of 400 years, became each day more obsolete and ambiguous, and their pedigree, instead of being enrolled in the annals of the kingdom, must be painfully searched by the minute diligence of heralds and genealogists. It was not till the end of the 16th century, on the accession of a family almost as remote as their own, that the princely spirit of the Courtenay again revived, and the question of the nobility provoked them to ascertain the royalty of their blood. They appealed to the justice and compassion of Henry IV, obtained a favorable opinion from 20 lawyers of Italy and Germany, and modestly compared themselves to the descendants of King David, whose prerogatives were not impaired by the lapse of ages or the trade of a carpenter. But every ear was deaf, and every circumstance was adverse to their lawful claims. The Bourbon kings were justified by the neglect of the Valois. The princes of the blood, more recent and lofty, disdained the alliance of his humble kindred. The Parliament, without denying their proofs, eluded a dangerous precedent by an arbitrary distinction, and established St. Louis as the first father of the royal line. A repetition of complaints and protests was repeatedly disregarded, and the hopeless pursuit was terminated in the present century by the death of the last male of the family. Their painful and anxious situation was alleviated by the pride of conscious virtue. They sternly rejected the temptations of fortune and favor, and a dying Courtenay would have sacrificed his son if the youth could have renounced, for any temporal interest, the right and title of a legitimate prince of the blood of France. According to the old register of Ford Abbey, the Courtenay of Devonshire are descended from Prince Florus, the second son of Peter and the grandson of Louis the Fat. this fable of the grateful or venal monks was too respectfully entertained by our antiquaries, Camden and Dugdale, but it is so clearly repugnant to truth and time that the rational pride of the family now refuses to accept this imaginary founder. The most faithful historians believe that after giving his daughter to the king's son, Reginald of Courtenay abandoned his possessions in France and obtained from the English monarch a second wife and a new inheritance. It is certain, at least, that Henry II distinguished in his camps and councils a Reginald of the name and arms, and, as it may be fairly presumed, of the genuine race of the Courtenay of France. The right of wardship enabled a feudal lord to reward his vassal with the marriage and estate of a noble heiress, and Reginald of Courtenay acquired a fair establishment in Devonshire, where his posterity has been seated above 600 years. From a Norman baron, Baldwin de Brioni, who had been invested by the Conqueror, her wise, the wife of Reginald, derived the honour of Okehampton, which was held by the service of 93 knights, and a female might claim the manly offices of hereditary viscount or sheriff, and of captain of the royal castle of Exeter. Their son, Robert, married the sister of the Earl of Devon. At the end of a century, on the failure of the family of Rivers, his great-grandson, Hugh II, succeeded to a title which was still considered as a territorial dignity. And 12 earls of Devonshire, of the name of Courtenay, have flourished in a period of 220 years. They were ranked among the chief of the barons of the realm, nor was it till after a strenuous dispute that they yielded to the fief of Arundel, the first place in the Parliament of England. Their alliances were contracted with the noblest families, the Verys, Despensers, St. John's, Talbots, Mohuns, and even the Plantagenets themselves. And in a contest with John of Lancaster, a Courtenay, Bishop of London, and afterwards Archbishop of Canterbury, might be accused of profane confidence in the strength and number of his kindred. In peace, the Earls of Devon resided in their numerous castles and manors of the West. Their ample revenue was appropriated to devotion and hospitality, and the epitaph of Edward, surnamed from his misfortune the Blind, from his virtues the Good Earl, inculcates with much ingenuity a moral sentence which may, however, be abused by thoughtless generosity. After a grateful commemoration of the 55 years of union and happiness which he enjoyed with Mabel, his wife, the good Earl thus speaks from the tomb. What we gave, we have. What we spent, we had. What we left, we lost. But their losses, in this sense, were far superior to their gifts and expenses, and their heirs, not less than the poor, were the objects of their paternal care. The sums which they paid for livery and seisin attest the greatness of their possessions, and several estates have remained in their family since the 13th and 14th centuries. In war, the Courtenay of England fulfilled the duties and deserved the honours of chivalry. They were often entrusted to levy and command the militia of Devonshire and Cornwall. They often attended their supreme lord to the borders of Scotland, and in foreign service, for a stipulated price, they sometimes maintained 80 men-at-arms and as many archers. By sea and land they fought under the standard of the Edwards and Henrys. Their names are conspicuous in battles, in tournaments, and in the original list of the Order of the Garter. 3 brothers share the Spanish victory of the Black Prince, and in the lapse of 6 generations, the English Courtenay had learned to despise the nation and country from which they derived their origin. In the quarrel of the 2 Roses, the Earls of Devon adhered to the House of Lancaster, and 3 brothers successively died, either in the field or on the scaffold. Their honours and estates were restored by Henry VII. A daughter of Edward IV was not disgraced by the nuptials of a Courtenay, and their son, who was created Marquis of Exeter, enjoy the favour of his cousin Henry VIII, and in the camp of Cloth of Gold he broke a lance against the French monarch. But the favour of Henry was the prelude of disgrace. His disgrace was the signal of death, and of the victims of the jealous tyrant, the Marquis of Exeter is one of the most noble and guiltless. His son Edward lived a prisoner in the Tower, and died in exile at Padua, and the secret love of Queen Mary, whom he slighted, perhaps for the Princess Elizabeth, has shed a romantic colour on the story of this beautiful youth. The relics of his patrimony were conveyed into strange families by the marriages of his four aunts, and his personal honours, as if they had been legally extinct, were revived by the patents of succeeding princes. But there still survived a lineal descendant of Hugh, the first Earl of Devon, a younger branch of the Courtenay, who had been seated at Powderham Castle above 400 years from the reign of Edward III to the present hour. Their estates have been increased by the grant and improvement of lands in Ireland, and they have been recently restored to the honours of the peerage. Yet the Courtenay still retain the plaintive motto which asserts the innocence and deplores the fall of their ancient house. While they sigh for past greatness, they are doubtless sensible of present blessings. In the long series of the Courtenay annals, the most splendid era is likewise the most unfortunate. Nor can an opulent peer of Britain be inclined to envy the emperors of Constantinople, who wandered over Europe to solicit alms for the support of their dignity and the defence of their capital. Chapter 62. The Greek Emperors of Nice and Constantinople. Elevation and Reign of Michael Palaeologus. His False Union with the Pope and the Latin Church. Hostile Designs of Charles of Anjou. Revolt of Sicily. War of the Catalans in Asia and Greece. Revolutions and Present State of Athens. The loss of Constantinople restored a momentary vigour to the Greeks. From their palaces, the princes and nobles were driven into the field, and the fragments of the failing monarchy were grasped by the hands of the most vigorous or the most skilful candidates. In the long and barren pages of the Byzantine annals, it would not be an easy task to equal the two characters of Theodore Lascaris and John Ducas Vataces, who replanted and upheld the Roman standard at Nice in Bithynia. The difference of their virtues was happily suited to the diversity of their situation. In his first efforts, the fugitive Lascaris commanded only 3 cities and 2,000 soldiers. His reign was the season of generous and active despair. In every military operation he staked his life and crown, and his enemies of the Hellespont and the Meander were surprised by his celerity and subdued by his boldness. A victorious reign of 18 years expanded the principality of Nice to the magnitude of an empire. The throne of his successor and son-in-law, Vataces, was founded on a more solid basis, a larger scope, and more plentiful resources. And it was the temper as well as the interest of Vataces to calculate the risk, to expect the moment, and to ensure the success of his ambitious designs. In the decline of the Latins I have briefly exposed the progress of the Greeks, the prudent and gradual advances of a conqueror, who, in a reign of 33 years, rescued the provinces from national and foreign usurpers, till he pressed on all sides the imperial city, a leafless and sapless trunk, which must fall at the first stroke of the axe. But his interior and peaceful administration is still more deserving of notice and praise. The calamities of the times had wasted the numbers and the substance of the Greeks. The motives and the means of agriculture were extirpated. and the most fertile lands were left without cultivation or inhabitants. A portion of this vacant property was occupied and improved by the command and for the benefit of the emperor. A powerful hand and a vigilant eye supplied and surpassed by skillful management the minute diligence of a private farmer. The royal domain became the garden and granary of Asia, and without impoverishing the people, the sovereign acquired a fund of innocent and productive wealth. According to the nature of the soil, his lands were sown with corn or planted with vines. The pastures were filled with horses and oxen, with sheep and hogs, and when Vataces presented to the empress a crown of diamonds and pearls, he informed her, with a smile, that this precious ornament arose from the sale of the eggs of his innumerable poultry. The produce of his domain was applied to the maintenance of his palace and hospitals, the calls of dignity and benevolence. The lesson was still more useful than the revenue. The plough was restored to its ancient security and honour, and the nobles were taught to seek a sure and independent revenue from their estates, instead of adorning their splendid beggary by the oppression of all the people, or, what is almost the same, by the favours of the court. The superfluous stock of corn and cattle was eagerly purchased by the Turks, with whom Vataces preserved a strict and sincere alliance. But he discouraged the importation of foreign manufactures, the costly silks of the East and the curious labours of the Italian looms. The demands of nature and necessity, was he accustomed to say, are indispensable, but the influence of fashion may rise and sink at the breath of a monarch. And both his precept and example recommended simplicity of manners and the use of domestic industry. The education of youth and the revival of learning were the most serious objects of his care, and without deciding the precedency, he pronounced with truth that a prince and a philosopher are the two most eminent characters of human society. His first wife was Irene, the daughter of Theodore Lascaris, a woman more illustrious by her personal merit, the milder virtues of her sex, than by the blood of the Angeli and Comnini that flowed in her veins, and transmitted the inheritance of the empire. After her death he was contracted to Anne, or Constance, a natural daughter of the Emperor Frederick II. But as the bride had not attained the years of puberty, Vataces placed in his solitary bed an Italian damsel of her train, and his amorous weakness bestowed on the concubine the honours, though not the title, of a lawful empress. His frailty was censured as a flagitious and damnable sin by the monks, and their rude invectives exercised and displayed the patience of the royal lover. A philosophic age may excuse a single vice, which was redeemed by a crowd of virtues, and in the review of his faults and the more intemperate passions of Lascaris, the judgment of their contemporaries was softened by the gratitude to the second founders of the empire. The slaves of the Latins, without law or peace, applauded the happiness of their brethren who had resumed their national freedom. And Vataces employed the laudable policy of convincing the Greeks of every dominion that it was their interest to be enrolled in the number of his subjects. A strong shade of degeneracy is visible between John Vataces and his son Theodore, between the founder who sustained the weight and the heir who enjoyed the splendor of the imperial crown. Yet the character of Theodore was not devoid of energy. He had been educated in the school of his father, in the exercise of war and hunting. Constantinople was yet spared, but in the 3 years of a short reign he thrice led his armies into the heart of Bulgaria. His virtues were sullied by a choleric and suspicious temper. The first of these may be ascribed to the ignorance of control, and the second might naturally arise from a dark and imperfect view of the corruption of mankind. On a march in Bulgaria he consulted on a question of policy his principal ministers, and the Greek logothete, George Acropolita, presumed to offend him by the declaration of a free and honest opinion. The emperor half unsheathed his scimitar, but his more deliberate rage reserved Acropolita for a baser punishment. One of the first officers of the Empire was ordered to dismount, stripped of his robes, and extended on the ground in the presence of the prince and army. In this posture he was chastised with so many and such heavy blows from the clubs of two guards or executioners that when Theodore commanded them to pause, the great Logothete was scarcely able to rise and crawl away to his tent. After a seclusion of some days, he was recalled by peremptory mandate to his seat in council, and so dead were the Greeks to the sense of honour and shame that it is from the narrative of the sufferer himself that we acquire the knowledge of his disgrace. The cruelty of the emperor was exasperated by the pangs of sickness, the approach of a premature end, and the suspicion of poison and magic. The lives and fortunes, the eyes and limbs of his kinsmen and nobles were sacrificed to each sally of passion. And before he died, the son of Vataces might deserve from the people, or at least from the court, the appellation of tyrant. A matron of the family of the Palaeologi had provoked his anger by refusing to bestow her beauteous daughter on the vile plebeian who was recommended by his caprice. Without regard to her birth or age, her body, as high as the neck, was enclosed in a sack with several cats, who were pricked with pins to irritate their fury against their unfortunate fellow-captive. In his last hours the emperor testified a wish to forgive and be forgiven, a just anxiety for the fate of John, his son and successor, who at the age of 8 years was condemned to the dangers of a long minority. His last choice entrusted the office of guardian to the sanctity of the patriarch Asinius, and to the courage of George Muzalon, the great domestic, who was equally distinguished by the royal favour and the public hatred. Since their connection with the Latins, the names and privileges of hereditary rank had insinuated themselves into the Greek monarchy, and the noble families were provoked by the elevation of a worthless favourite, to whose influence they imputed the errors and calamities of the late reign. In the first council, after the emperor's death, Muzalon, from a lofty throne, pronounced a laboured apology of his conduct and intentions. His modesty was subdued by unanimous assurance of esteem and fidelity, and his most inveterate enemies were the loudest to salute him as the guardian and saviour of the Romans. 8 days were sufficient to prepare the execution of the conspiracy. On the 9th, the obsequies of the deceased monarch were solemnized in the Cathedral of Magnesia, an Asiatic city where he expired on the banks of the Hemus and at the foot of Mount Sipylus. The holy rites were interrupted by a sedition of the guards. Muzalon, his brothers and his adherents, were massacred at the foot of the altar, and the absent patriarch was associated with a new colleague, with Michael Palaeologus, the most illustrious in birth and merit of the Greek nobles. Of those who are proud of their ancestors, the far greater part must be content with local or domestic renown, and few there are who dare trust the memorials of their family to the public annals of their country. As early as the middle of the 11th century, the noble race of the Palaeologi stands high and conspicuous in the Byzantine history. It was the valiant George Palaeologus who placed the father of the Comnini on the throne, and his kinsmen or descendants continue in each generation to lead the armies and councils of the state. The purple was not dishonored by their alliance, and had the law of succession and female succession been strictly observed, the wife of Theodore Lascaris must have yielded to her elder sister, the mother of Michael Palaeologus, who afterwards raised his family to the throne. In his person, the splendor of birth was dignified by the merit of the soldier and statesman. In his early youth, he was promoted to the office of constable or commander of the French mercenaries. The private expense of a day never exceeded 3 pieces of gold, but his ambition was rapacious and profuse, and his gifts were doubled by the graces of his conversation and manners. The love of the soldiers and people excited the jealousy of the court, and Michael thrice escaped from the dangers in which he was involved by his own imprudence or that of his friends. Under the reign of Justice and Vatekis, a dispute arose between two officers, one of whom accused the other of maintaining the hereditary right of the Palaeologi. The cause was decided, according to the new jurisprudence of the Latins, by single combat. The defendant was overthrown, but he persisted in declaring that himself alone was guilty, and that he had uttered these rash or treasonable speeches without the approbation or knowledge of his patron. Yet a cloud of suspicion hung over the innocence of the constable. He was still pursued by the whispers of malevolence, and a subtle courtier, the Archbishop of Philadelphia, urged him to accept the judgment of God in the fiery proof of the ordeal. 3 days before the trial, the patient's arm was enclosed in a bag and secured by the royal signet, and it was incumbent on him to bear a red-hot ball of iron 3 times from the altar to the rails of the sanctuary, without artifice and without injury. Palaeologus eluded the dangerous experiment with sense and pleasantry. "I am a soldier," said he, "and will boldly enter the lists with my accusers. But a layman, a sinner like myself, is not endowed with the gift of miracles. Your piety, most holy prelate, may deserve the interposition of heaven, and from your hands I will receive the fiery globe, the pledge of my innocence." The archbishop started. The emperor smiled, and the absolution or pardon of Michael was approved by new rewards and new services. In the succeeding reign, as he held the government of Nice, he was secretly informed that the mind of the absent prince was poisoned with jealousy, and that death or blindness would be his final reward. Instead of awaiting the return and sentence of Theodore, the constable, with some followers, escaped from the city and the empire. And though he was plundered by the Turkmens of the desert, he found a hospitable refuge in the court of the Sultan. In the ambiguous state of an exile, Michael reconciled the duties of gratitude and loyalty, drawing his sword against the Tatars, admonishing the garrisons of the Roman limit, and promoting by his influence the restoration of peace, in which his pardon and recall were honorably included. While he guarded the West against the despot of Epirus, Michael was again suspected and condemned in the palace, and such was his loyalty or weakness that he submitted to be led in chains above 600 miles from Durazzo to Nice. The civility of the messenger alleviated his disgrace. The emperor's sickness dispelled his danger, and the last breath of Theodore, which recommended his infant son, at once acknowledged the innocence and the power of Palaeologus. But his innocence had been too unworthily treated, and his power was too strongly felt to curb an aspiring subject in the fair field that was opened to his ambition. In the council after the death of Theodore, he was the first to pronounce and the first to violate the oath of allegiance to Musolon, and so dexterous was his conduct that he reaped the benefit without incurring the guilt, or at least the reproach, of the subsequent massacre. In the choice of a regent, he balanced the interests and passions of the candidates, turned their envy and hatred from himself against each other, and forced every competitor to own that after his own claims, those of Palaeologus were best entitled to the preference. Under the title of Great Duke, he accepted or assumed, during a long minority, the active powers of government. The patriarch was a venerable name, and the factious nobles were seduced or oppressed by the ascendant of his genius. The fruits of the economy of Vatekis were deposited in a strong castle on the banks of the Hemus, in the custody of the faithful Varangians. The constable retained his command or influence over the foreign troops. He employed the guards to possess the treasure, and the treasure to corrupt the guards. And whatever might be the abuse of the public money, his character was above the suspicion of private avarice. By himself or by his emissaries, he strove to persuade every rank of subjects that their own prosperity would rise in just proportion to the establishment of his authority. The weight of taxes was suspended, the perpetual theme of popular complaint, and he prohibited the trials by the ordeal and judicial combat. These barbaric institutions were already abolished or undermined in France and England, and the appeal to the sword offended the sense of a civilized and the temper of an unwarlike people. For the future maintenance of their wives and children, the veterans were grateful. The priests and the philosophers applauded his ardent zeal for the advancement of religion and learning, and his vague promise of rewarding merit was applied by every candidate to his own hopes. Conscious of the influence of the clergy, Michael successfully labored to secure the suffrage of that powerful order. Their expensive journey from Nice to Magnesia afforded a decent and ample pretense. The leading prelates were tempted by the liberality of his nocturnal visits, and the incorruptible patriarch was flattered by the homage of his new colleague, who led his mule by the bridle into the town, and removed to a respectful distance the importunity of the crowd. Without renouncing his title by royal descent, Palaeologus encouraged a free discussion into the advantages of elective monarchy, and his adherents asked, with the insolence of triumph, what patient would trust his health, or what merchants would abandon his vessel to the hereditary skill of a physician or a pilot? The youth of the emperor and the impending dangers of a minority required the support of a mature and experienced guardian, of an associate raised above the envy of his equals, and invested with the name and prerogatives of royalty. For the interest of the prince and people, without any selfish views for himself or his family, the great duke consented to guard and instruct the son of Theodore. But he sighed for the happy moment when he might restore to his firmer hands the administration of his patrimony, and enjoyed the blessings of a private station. He was first invested with the title and prerogatives of despot, which bestowed the purple ornaments and the second place in the Roman monarchy. It was afterwards agreed that John and Michael should be proclaimed as joint emperors, and raised on the buckler, but that the preeminence should be reserved for the birthright of the former. A mutual league of amity was pledged between the royal partners, and in the case of a rupture, the subjects were bound by their oath of allegiance to declare themselves against the aggressor. An ambiguous name, the seed of discord and civil war. Palaeologus was content, but on the day of the coronation, and in the cathedral of Nice, his zealous adherents most vehemently urged the just priority of his age and merit. The unseasonable dispute was eluded by postponing to a more convenient opportunity the coronation of John Lascaris, and he walked with a slight diadem in the train of his guardian, who alone received the imperial crown from the hands of the patriarch. It was not without extreme reluctance that Arsenius abandoned the cause of his pupil. Out the Varangians brandished their battle-axes. A sign of assent was extorted from the trembling youth, and some voices were heard that the life of a child should no longer impede the settlement of the nation. A full harvest of honors and employments was distributed among his friends by the grateful Palaeologus. In his own family he created a despot and two Sebastocrators. Alexius Strategolopoulos was decorated with the title of Caesar, and that veteran commander soon repaid the obligation by restoring Constantinople to the Greek emperor. It was in the second year of his reign, while he resided in the palace and gardens of Nymphaeum near Smyrna, that the first messenger arrived at the dead of night, and the stupendous intelligence was imparted to Michael after he had been gently waked by the tender precaution of his sister Eulogia. The man was unknown or obscure. He produced no letters from the victorious Caesar, nor could it be easily credited after the defeat of Vataces and the recent failure of Palaeologus himself that the capital had been surprised by a detachment of 800 soldiers. As a hostage, the doubtful author was confined with the assurance of death or an ample recompense, and the court was left some hours in the anxiety of hope and fear until the messengers of Alexius arrived with the authentic intelligence and displayed the trophies of the conquest, the sword and scepter, the buskins and bonnet of the usurper Baldwin, which he had dropped in his precipitate flight. A general assembly of the bishops, senators, and nobles was immediately convened, and never perhaps was an event received with more heartfelt and universal joy. In a studied oration, the new sovereign of Constantinople congratulated his own and the public fortune. "There was a time," said he, "a far distant time, when the Roman Empire extended to the Adriatic, the Tigris, and the confines of Ethiopia. After the loss of the provinces, our capital itself in these last and calamitous days has been wrested from our hands by the barbarians of the West. From the lowest ebb, the tide of prosperity has again returned in our favor. But our prosperity was that of fugitives and exiles, and when we were asked which was the country of the Romans, we indicated with a blush the climate of the globe and the quarter of the heavens. The divine providence has now restored to our arms the city of Constantine, the sacred seat of religion and empire, and it will depend on our valor and conduct to render this important acquisition the pledge and omen of future victories." So eager was the impatience of the prince and people that Michael made his triumphal entry into Constantinople only 20 days after the expulsion of the Latins. The Golden Gate was thrown open at his approach. The devout conqueror dismounted from his horse, and a miraculous image of Mary the conductress was borne before him, that the Divine Virgin in person might appear to conduct him to the temple of her son, the Cathedral of Santa Sophia. But after the first transport of devotion and pride, he sighed at the dreary prospect of solitude and ruin. The palace was defiled with smoke and dirt, and the gross intemperance of the Franks. Whole streets had been consumed by fire, or were decayed by the injuries of time. The sacred and profane edifices were stripped of their ornaments, and as if they were conscious of their approaching exile, the industry of the Latins had been confined to the work of pillage and destruction. Trade had expired under the pressure of anarchy and distress, and the numbers of inhabitants had decreased with the opulence of the city. It was the first care of the Greek monarch to reinstate the nobles in the palaces of their fathers, and the houses or the ground which they occupied were restored to the families that could exhibit a legal right of inheritance. But the far greater part was extinct or lost. The vacant property had devolved to the Lord. He repeopled Constantinople by a liberal invitation to the provinces, and the brave volunteers were seated in the capital which had been recovered by their arms. The French barons and the principal families had retired with their emperor, but the patient and humble crowd of Latins was attached to the country, and indifferent to the change of masters. Instead of banishing the factories of the Pisans, Venetians, and Genoese, the prudent conqueror accepted their oaths of allegiance, encouraged their industry, confirmed their privileges, and allowed them to live under the jurisdiction of their proper magistrates. Of these nations, the Pisans and Venetians preserved their respective quarters in the city, but the services and power of the Genoese deserved at the same time the gratitude and the jealousy of the Greeks. Their independent colony was first planted at the seaport town of Heraclea in Thrace. They were speedily recalled and settled in the exclusive possession of the suburb of Galata, an advantageous post in which they revived the commerce and insulted the majesty of the Byzantine Empire. The recovery of Constantinople was celebrated as the era of a new empire. The conqueror, alone and by the right of the sword, renewed his coronation in the church of Santa Sophia. and the name and honours of John Lascaris, his pupil and lawful sovereign, were insensibly abolished. But his claims still lived in the minds of the people, and the royal youth must speedily attain the years of manhood and ambition. By fear or conscience, Palaeologus was restrained from dipping his hands in innocent and royal blood. But the anxiety of a usurper and a parent urged him to secure his throne by one of those imperfect crimes so familiar to the modern Greeks. The loss of sight incapacitated the young prince for the active business of the world. Instead of the brutal violence of tearing out his eyes, the visual nerve was destroyed by the intense glare of a red-hot basin. And John Lascaris was removed to a distant castle, where he spent many years in privacy and oblivion. Such cool and deliberate guilt may seem incompatible with remorse, but if Michael could trust the mercy of heaven, he was not inaccessible to the reproaches and vengeance of mankind which he had provoked by cruelty and treason. His cruelty imposed on a servile court the duties of applause or silence, but the clergy had a right to speak in the name of their invisible master, and their holy legions were led by a prelate whose character was above the temptations of hope or fear. After a short abdication of his dignity, Arsenius had consented to ascend the ecclesiastical throne of Constantinople and to preside in the restoration of the church. His pious simplicity was long deceived by the arts of Palaeologus, and his patience and submission might soothe the usurper and protect the safety of the young prince. On the news of his inhuman treatment, the patriarch unsheathed the spiritual sword, and superstition, on this occasion, was enlisted in the cause of humanity and justice. In a synod of bishops who were stimulated by the example of his zeal, the patriarch pronounced a sentence of excommunication, though his prudence still repeated the name of Michael in the public prayers. The eastern prelates had not adopted the dangerous maxims of ancient Rome, nor did they presume to enforce their censures by deposing princes or absolving nations from their oaths of allegiance. But the Christian, who had been separated from God and the Church, became an object of horror, and in a turbulent and fanatic capital, that horror might aim the hand of an assassin or inflame a sedition of the people. Palaeologus felt his danger, confessed his guilt, and deprecated his judge. The act was irretrievable, the prize was obtained, and the most rigorous penance which he solicited would have raised the sinner to the reputation of a saint. The unrelenting patriarch refused to announce any means of atonement or any hopes of mercy, and condescended only to pronounce that for so great a crime, great indeed must be the satisfaction. "Do you require," said Michael, "that I should abdicate the empire?" And at these words he offered, or seemed to offer, the sword of state. Arsenius eagerly grasped this pledge of sovereignty, but when he perceived that the emperor was unwilling to purchase absolution at so dear a rate, he indignantly escaped to his cell, and left the royal sinner kneeling and weeping before the door. The danger and scandal of this excommunication subsisted above 3 years, till the popular clamour was assuaged by time and repentance, till the brethren of Arsenius condemned his inflexible spirit, so repugnant to the unbounded forgiveness of the gospel. The emperor had artfully insinuated that if he were still rejected at home, he might seek, in the Roman pontiff, a more indulgent judge. But it was far more easy and effectual to find or to place that judge at the head of the Byzantine Church. Arsenius was involved in a vague rumor of conspiracy and disaffection. Some irregular steps in his ordination and government were liable to censure. A synod deposed him from the episcopal office, and he was transported under a guard of soldiers to a small island of the Propontis. Before his exile, he sullenly requested that a strict account might be taken of the treasures of the church. boasted that his sole riches, 3 pieces of gold, had been earned by transcribing the Psalms, continued to assert the freedom of his mind, and denied, with his last breath, the pardon which was implored by the royal sinner. After some delay, Gregory, Bishop of Adrianople, was translated to the Byzantine throne. But his authority was found insufficient to support the absolution of the emperor, and Joseph, a revered monk, was substituted to that important function. This edifying scene was represented in the presence of the Senate and the people. At the end of 6 years, the humble penitent was restored to the communion of the faithful, and humanity will rejoice that a milder treatment of the captive Lascaris was stipulated as a proof of his remorse. But the spirit of Arsenius still survived in a powerful faction of the monks and clergy, who persevered about 48 years in an obstinate schism. Their scruples were treated with tenderness and respect by Michael and his son, and the reconciliation of the Arsenites was the serious labor of the church and state. In the confidence of fanaticism, they had proposed to try their cause by a miracle, and when the 2 papers that contained their own and the adverse cause were cast into a fiery brazier, they expected that the Catholic verity would be respected by the flames. Alas, the 2 papers were indiscriminately consumed, and this unforeseen accident produced the union of a day and renewed the quarrel of an age. The final treaty displayed the victory of the Arsenites. The clergy abstained during 40 days from all ecclesiastical functions. A slight penance was imposed on the laity. The body of Arsenius was deposited in the sanctuary, and in the name of the departed saint, the prince and people were released from the sins of their fathers. The establishment of his family was the motive, or at least the pretense, of the crime of Palaeologus, and he was impatient to confirm the succession by sharing with his eldest son the honors of the purple. Andronicus, afterwards surnamed the Elder, was proclaimed and crowned Emperor of the Romans in the 15th year of his age, and from the first era of a prolix and inglorious reign, he held that august title 9 years as the colleague and 50 as the successor of his father. Michael himself, had he died in a private station, would have been thought more worthy of the empire, and the assaults of his temporal and spiritual enemies left him few moments to labor for his own fame or the happiness of his subjects. He wrested from the Franks several of the noblest islands of the archipelago, Lesbos, Chios, and Rhodes. His brother Constantine was sent to command in Malvasia and Sparta, and the eastern side of the Morea, from Argos and Napoli to Cape Finnes, was repossessed by the Greeks. This effusion of Christian blood was loudly condemned by the patriarch, and the insolent priest presumed to interpose his fears and scruples between the arms of princes. But in the prosecution of these western conquests, the countries beyond the Hellespont were left naked to the Turks, and their depredations verified the prophecy of a dying senator that the recovery of Constantinople would be the ruin of Asia. The victories of Michael were achieved by his lieutenants. His sword rusted in the palace. And, in the transactions of the emperor with the popes and the king of Naples, his political acts were stained with cruelty and fraud. The Vatican was the most natural refuge of a Latin emperor who had been driven from his throne, and Pope Urban IV appeared to pity the misfortunes and vindicate the cause of the fugitive Baldwin. A crusade with plenary indulgence was preached by his command against the schismatic Greeks. He excommunicated their allies and adherents, solicited Louis IX in favor of his kinsmen, and demanded a tenth of the ecclesiastical revenues of France and England for the service of the Holy War. The subtle Greek who watched the rising tempest of the West attempted to suspend or soothe the hostility of the Pope by suppliant embassies and respectful letters, but he insinuated that the establishment of peace must prepare the reconciliation and obedience of the Eastern Church. The Roman court could not be deceived by so gross an artifice, and Michael was admonished that the repentance of the son should precede the forgiveness of the father, and that faith, an ambiguous word, was the only basis of friendship and alliance. After a long and affected delay, the approach of danger and the importunity of Gregory X compelled him to enter on a more serious negotiation. He alleged the example of the great Vataeces, and the Greek clergy, who understood the intentions of their prince, were not alarmed by the first steps of reconciliation and respect. But when he pressed the conclusion of the treaty, they strenuously declared that the Latins, though not in name, were heretics in fact, and that they despised those strangers as the vilest and most despicable portion of the human race. It was the task of the emperor to persuade, to corrupt, to intimidate the most popular ecclesiastics, to gain the vote of each individual, and alternately to urge the arguments of Christian charity and the public welfare. The texts of the fathers and the arms of the Franks were balanced in the theological and political scale, and without proving the addition to the Nicene Creed, the most moderate were taught to confess that the two hostile propositions of proceeding from the Father by the Son and of proceeding from the Father and the Son might be reduced to a safe and Catholic sense. The supremacy of the Pope was a doctrine more easy to conceive, but more painful to acknowledge. Yet Michael represented to his monks and prelates that they might submit to name the Roman bishop as the first of the patriarchs, and that their distance and discretion would guard the liberties of the Eastern Church from the mischievous consequences of the right of appeal. He protested that he would sacrifice his life and empire rather than yield the smallest point of Orthodox faith or national independence, and this declaration was sealed and ratified by a golden bull. The patriarch Joseph withdrew to a monastery to resign or resume his throne according to the event of the treaty. The letters of union and obedience were subscribed by the emperor, his son Andronicus, and 35 archbishops and metropolitans, with their respective synods, and the episcopal list was multiplied by many dioceses which were annihilated under the yoke of the infidels. An embassy was composed of some trusty ministers and prelates. They embarked for Italy with rich ornaments and rare perfumes for the altar of St. Peter, and their secret orders authorized and recommended a boundless compliance. They were received in the General Council of Lyon by Pope Gregory X, at the head of 500 bishops. He embraced with tears his long-lost and repentant children, accepted the oath of the ambassadors, who abjured the schism in the name of the two emperors, adorned the prelates with the ring and mitre, chanted in Greek and Latin the Nicene Creed with the addition of filioque, and rejoiced in the union of the East and West, which had been reserved for his reign. To consummate this pious work, the Byzantine deputies were speedily followed by the Pope's nuncios, and their instruction discloses the policy of the Vatican, which could not be satisfied with the vain title of supremacy. After viewing the temper of the prince and people, they were enjoined to absolve the schismatic clergy, who should subscribe and swear their abjuration and obedience, to establish in all the churches the use of the perfect creed, to prepare the entrance of a cardinal legate with the full powers and dignity of his office, and to instruct the emperor in the advantages which he might derive from the temporal protection of the Roman pontiff. But they found a country without a friend, a nation in which the names of Rome and Union were pronounced with abhorrence. The patriarch Joseph was indeed removed. His place was filled by Vecus, an ecclesiastic of learning and moderation. And the emperor was still urged by the same motives to persevere in the same professions. But in his private language, Palaeologus affected to deplore the pride and to blame the innovations of the Latins. And while he debased his character by this double hypocrisy, he justified and punished the opposition of his subjects. By the joint suffrage of the new and the ancient Rome, a sentence of excommunication was pronounced against the obstinate schismatics. the censures of the church were executed by the sword of Michael. On the failure of persuasion, he tried the arguments of prison and exile, of whipping and mutilation. Those touchstones, says an historian, of cowards and the brave. Two Greeks still reigned in Aetolia, Epirus and Thessaly, with the appellation of despots. They had yielded to the sovereign of Constantinople, but they rejected the chains of the Roman pontiff, and supported their refusal by successful arms. Under their protection, the fugitive monks and bishops assembled in hostile synods, and retorted the name of heretic with the galling addition of apostate. The prince of Trebizond was tempted to assume the forfeit title of emperor, and even the Latins of Negropont, Thebes, Athens, and the Morea forgot the merits of the convert to join with open or clandestine aid the enemies of Palaeologus. His favorite generals, of his own blood and family, successively deserted or betrayed the sacrilegious trust. His sister Eulogia, a niece, and two female cousins conspired against him. Another niece, Mary, Queen of Bulgaria, negotiated his ruin with the Sultan of Egypt, and in the public eye their treason was consecrated as the most sublime virtue. To the Pope's nuncios, who urged the consummation of the work, Palaeologus exposed a naked recital of all that he had done and suffered for their sake. They were assured that the guilty sectaries of both sexes and every rank had been deprived of their honors, their fortunes, and their liberty. A spreading list of confiscation and punishment, which involved many persons, the dearest to the emperor, or the best deserving of his favor. They were conducted to the prison to behold four princes of the royal blood chained in the four corners and shaking their fetters in an agony of grief and rage. Two of these captives were afterwards released, the one by submission, the other by death. But the obstinacy of their two companions was chastised by the loss of their eyes. And the Greeks, the least adverse to the union, deplored that cruel and inauspicious tragedy. Persecutors must expect the hatred of those whom they oppress, but they commonly find some consolation in the testimony of their conscience, the applause of their party, and, perhaps, the success of their undertaking. But the hypocrisy of Michael, which was prompted only by political motives, must have forced him to hate himself, to despise his followers, and to esteem and envy the rebel champions by whom he was detested and despised. While his violence was abhorred at Constantinople, at Rome his slowness was arraigned and his sincerity suspected, till at length Pope Martin IV excluded the Greek emperor from the pale of a church into which he was striving to reduce a schismatic people. No sooner had the tyrant expired than the union was dissolved and abjured by unanimous consent. The churches were purified, the penates were reconciled, and his son Andronicus, after weeping the sins and errors of his youth most piously, denied his father the burial of a prince and a Christian. In the distress of the Latins, the walls and towers of Constantinople had fallen to decay. They were restored and fortified by the policy of Michael, who deposited a plenteous store of corn and salt provisions to sustain the siege which he might hourly expect from the resentment of the Western powers. Of these, the sovereign of the two Sicilies was the most formidable neighbor, but as long as they were possessed by Mainfroid, the bastard of Frederick II, his monarchy was the bulwark rather than the annoyance of the Eastern Empire. The usurper, though a brave and active prince, was sufficiently employed in the defense of his throne. His prescription by successive popes had separated Mainfroid from the common cause of the Latins, and the forces that might have besieged